Welcome to Close Up. I'm Joseph McCaffrey, and my guest is the junior senator from the state of Kansas, Bob Dole. Republican Senator Dole is a much decorated veteran of World War II, in which he served for 5.5 years, being wounded twice, spending 39 months in military hospitals. The senator won his AB and LLB degrees from Washburn Municipal University at Topeka. At the age of 26, he was elected to the state legislature. Then he was elected 4 terms as Russell County Attorney, serving until he was elected to the House of Representatives in 1960. 8 years later, in 1968, he was elected to the United States Senate. As a member of the Senate, he has been active as a leader of the conservative wing of the party, took the lead in backing Judge Harold Carswell for the Supreme Court, and he's often mentioned as a possible candidate for one of the Republican Senate leadership spots in the new Congress, the coming 92nd Congress. The senator serves on the Agriculture Committee, Public Works Committee, the Select Committee on Small Business, and the Senate Committee on Hunger. And in 1 minute, we'll meet Senator Bob Dole of Kansas.
What's Red Cross service to the military all about? Ask a wounded GI, Sergeant Irvin Dane.
Well, the main thing that stands out in my mind is the Red Cross centers in Vietnam. I know they were a high point of several of our days over there whenever we were able to get off work. We stopped by Red Cross centers, and they had evenings planned just about every night of the week.
And when men get hurt, Red Cross is there.
When you're flat on your back with a cast on your leg or something like that, and you can't get out of bed for days or weeks at a time, and you have Red Cross girls come in here at nights, off and on, and play bingo, or they have games and refreshments of different sorts. It's very important to somebody that can't move at all or can't get up and do it for themselves to have someone come in and entertain them like that.
What's Red Cross service to the military all about? Helping guys like Irvin Dane is what it's all about.
Senator Dole, you were handicapped as a result of World War II, and you've been very active over the years in trying to help the handicapped. Do you think that we're doing enough for those who have handicaps?
I think we're making a better effort. Unfortunately, it takes a war, I guess, to really emphasize the needs of handicapped Americans. When we stop to consider that about 1 out of 5 Americans has a physical or an emotional or mental handicap of some kind, it indicates the gravity and the scope of the problem. So I made my first speech in the Senate about handicapped Americans, and I followed up this year on the same day, April 14, which is an anniversary date that I was wounded back in 1945. So in some small way, we hope to be able to stress the need for continuous action with reference to handicapped. Also, the great potential handicapped Americans have. I don't really believe I'm handicapped, but I do have some physical limitation. Now, and I think there are many other handicapped Americans who have great potential and great ability if only given the opportunity.
We have to break down the prejudice, don't we? How are we doing in that field?
Well, as I've said many times, we've gone through an era where we put people on one part of the bus and other people on the other part of the bus. Many handicapped can't get on the bus at all. We find many handicapped Americans have no access to restaurants or hotels or public buildings because of architecture. So I think we must, first of all, through efforts, not only people in public office, but public service programs, people throughout America, rich, young, black, white, young or old, makes no difference. We need to emphasize the great potential handicapped have. They're not offensive. They can work. They can do about anything a normal human can do.
You were sworn in as a member of the United States Senate in the same month Mr. Nixon was sworn in as president. First of all, how do you think you're doing, and how do you think the president's doing?
Well, I would guess on balance, I'm doing all right, though, of course, this will be tested again in 1974. I would also think on balance the president is doing an excellent job. I've been a strong Nixon supporter. When I can't support the president, I don't remain quiet, but I try not to make it a head-on attack. I don't question the president's motives in any area. I sometimes question the way things do happen in the White House or in other agencies. So I would guess, I would give him very high marks, and I'd give myself passing marks.
How much advantage did you have coming in as a freshman senator because of the fact you had House experience?
Oh, I think it's invaluable. I think anyone who comes in from maybe a governorship or some statewide office or from literally just off the street comes in at a great disadvantage. And I say this because I know most every Republican and Democrat House member, having been there 8 years, you've developed some strong friendships, not based on politics, but just based on men and women. So I would say it was invaluable, and it's been helpful to me as a senator to go over on the House floor, visit with Democrats and Republicans, my friends, about issues, about problems, and just to maintain the friendship. It may be more important later on, and when you find many senators who may not know any more than their own delegation or their counterparts on some committee in the House. So I find it a great asset and very valuable.
Senator, for the last many days, it seems to me as if there's been a pall hanging over the Capitol because of the Southeast Asian problem. What do you think of our going into Cambodia?
Well, I hope, first of all, it was the right choice. And again, I certainly have every confidence in the president's motives and his and the effort. I do have, and I've said so publicly, some reservations. I've yet to have the assurance I need that, first of all, it's the effort into Cambodia was to protect American troops, and secondly, that it will bring about Vietnamization on schedule or ahead of schedule. Now, I don't get fuzzed up or hung up with any international law problem. I don't believe a boundary line is as important as an American life, so I don't quarrel with all the legalistic arguments. I don't say it's an extension of the war, but I've attended two or three briefings and have yet to have some doubts. I hope I can resolve them in favor of the president, because I normally support the president. But I have these doubts about whether, in fact, this may be a way to shore up the Cambodian government, or whether it is a direct effort to protect American troops and a direct effort to keep a Vietnamization program on schedule.
I don't want to try to oversimplify the problems facing us today, but it seems to me, Senator, that our greatest problem today is a complete breakdown in communications. I've talked to you and others in the Senate and in the House, and really they don't seem to know much more than I do, and I just have a general reporter's view, and I just wonder if the President really is getting as much information as to what's happening in Southeast Asia as he should.
Well, I think perhaps the President is, but there's not much seepage. It may not get beyond the Oval Office many times.
I think this helps this frustration, too.
And there are some members who are well-intentioned members of the House and Senate who are deeply concerned, deeply frustrated. They made commitments in advance that they would go along with advisors, go along with equipment, go along with sending South Vietnamese into Cambodia. But there they drew the line, never thinking, in fact, based on statements previously made by some in the administration, that we would send combat troops. And frankly, I find myself in this dilemma. I went along with advisors. I went along with South Vietnamese. I would go along with sending equipment to Cambodia to protect their government, but I wouldn't go as far as to send combat troops in to help the Cambodian army. Now, I recognize the fine distinction. We're not in Cambodia now. American troops, some 12 or 13,000 at this point, to help the Cambodian army. We are there, as I'm told, day after day, and I tend to believe it, to protect American lives and to keep the Vietnamization program on schedule. But I certainly feel it's not a criticism to say that we need to improve our communications between the White House and the Congress and the American people.
Forgetting the military and diplomatic ramifications in Southeast Asia, do you think that proper consideration was given to weighing the impact of such a move domestically here in this country?
I would guess this was certainly a high priority when they made a decision, when the president finally made this difficult decision, which I give him credit for making because it was difficult. He did have to reject all political considerations. But here again, had there been some dialogue between someone in the White House and members of Congress, particularly members of the House, who have a better feel for the people than senators, because we have the 6 year. They would have learned very quickly that there would be a strong reaction. In fact, I said the night of the announcement that this would bring about an adverse reaction, a sharp downturn in support of the president's policies. I didn't invite it. I just felt it was coming. and from my state of Kansas it came.
What is your mail showing?
About 60-40 against Cambodia. Many people who support the Vietnamization program, support President Nixon, but they weren't prepared. They thought this couldn't happen. Now, I understand, of course, the rationale is that there was a buildup in these sanctuary areas 8 or 10 days prior to the announcement, that you can't telegraph your punch, and I don't ask for that. But it seems to me it's not only a good practical military politics, but it's good politics, period, to have some input from those of us who are on the firing line, or more input.
Remember the United States Senate. You're a very young man. You're a handsome man, dynamic man, and you make many appearances on college campuses, and generally you're very well accepted. What is your thinking about what this war has done to the college students?
Well, I've talked with some, including five young men from Kent State University.
Congressman Stanton had here.
Right, and they're fine young men. Two were leaders in their school. Two were witnesses to the tragedy at Kent State University.
One, I guess, held one of the boys who died.
Yes, it was a very moving dialogue between the students, myself, and Senator Saxby. It was in his office, and I appreciated the opportunity to be there. I've discussed Cambodia and Vietnam and President Nixon and Vice President Agnew with students from Kansas. And again, the ones who've been here from Kansas aren't necessarily here to kick the president around. They're not here as a Democrat or Republican. They're here because they're in the age group that must pay the price.
They're here as frustrated Americans.
Frustrated Americans. So we've had good conversations. I've listened and I've expressed my view. I pointed out what I think to be the height of folly in the so-called McGovern-Hatfield resolution, which would cut off funds or declare war by December 31, 1970. But I have listened and I have learned, and I think perhaps there is a greater frustration on the American campus. But I have enough confidence, again, in President Nixon. Certainly he's been through the political mill. Certainly he understands what happens when a group at least feels ignored. Maybe they haven't been. So I would anticipate and predict more emphasis on dialogue with young people across the country.
Have you been concerned or upset about what could be called, in some context, inflammatory language that's been used, even by the president, I think, in a very unfortunate reference to bums on campus, and to some of the things Vice President Agnew has been saying, which seem to me come at a very sensitive, very delicate time. At some other context, it might be all right, but I just wonder about, in our present turbulent situation, if everybody shouldn't be more careful.
Well, I would guess this is true, and of course, particularly when the remarks are made a week or 2 weeks or a month or 6 months ago, and then it's followed by the tragedy we have at Kent State, because you can do about anything with that you wish. I accept it as a tragedy, and I don't condone it. I don't want it to happen again. But there must be a realization somewhere along the line that there have been some rather sharp invectives on the other side. And again, I'm pleased with most of the students I've talked with. They're not here to shout obscenities. They're not here to burn the flag or to storm the Pentagon or the White House. They're here as frustrated young Americans.
I don't think we can lump all students together.
Right.
I think
there are some revolutionaries, and they have visited campuses in Kansas. We have had, as recently as April 20, a student union burned down in Kansas. My own fraternity house was burned down, and there's some thought that may be a result of arson. So it's not just happening in the East. It's not just happening in Ohio. It's happening in Kansas,
happening
California,
in Middle America, and this
everywhere.
Is why it should be very alarming.
Middle America with middle Americans. Young people from middle-class families, white, black, and otherwise. So I think perhaps I would hope, and I believe you will see a greater activity by the president and by others close to the president in trying to circumscribe the dialogue, but to increase it and to do what we can do to sort of cool things at this time.
It may be, as some say, that this would happen anyway, but I believe that certainly one of the root causes is the war in Vietnam.
I think it was predictable. And I don't fault Vice President Agnew for saying it was predictable. I think Senator Hatfield has said recently that violence begets violence. And I would point out, too, that many of the young National Guardsmen are probably the same age as the young men and young women who are frustrated. They're not there by choice. The only difference is they have on the uniform. And they also have a breaking point. I mean, we accept the right of a student to break and to explode, literally. So we have to give the young man, the National Guard, or some young policeman, that same right. It may not be right, but it does happen.
Senator, what is your hope for bringing this war to a close?
Well, I have great confidence in the President's Vietnamization program, and that's why, if the action in Cambodia is necessary to keep it on schedule or even increase it or accelerate it, I hope, this is how we're going to end. But at the same time, we must continue our efforts to negotiate in Paris. Now, even though this past week, the North Vietnamese and the Liberation Front didn't appear in Paris, they promised they would be there next week. And there's always the thought, and I hope the hope present, that perhaps this activity in Cambodia means they can't bluff us any longer, that the President meant what he said last year and this year, that we would respond. And it might bring about peace at the negotiating table even more quickly than Vietnamization.
Suppose it works the other way, Senator. Supposing the casualties do go up. Supposing we're no closer to anything at the peace table. Where are we then?
Well, then I think if that happens, and I can't believe that will happen. I don't want to believe it will happen.
I guess
maybe
not,
that's
but too, probably.
Then, of course, the President's already indicated what would happen politically. But again, as I agree with him, that's a secondary importance. Whether or not a Republican or Democrat might lose his seat because of what he says about the war is perhaps secondary. But then we'd have to continue, in my thought, with the Vietnamization program. Maybe, as Senator Aiken suggested, maybe partly in jest a year ago, declare victory and move on. But I just don't believe the American people will tolerate any great change in the Vietnam War as far as escalation. I think the President...
They haven't tolerated in the last 2 weeks.
It's been demonstrated just what this little excursion does. Now, if it succeeds, we're now operating in about 6 sanctuaries. If it succeeds, the President will have made the right decision, obviously. If it fails, he's obviously made the wrong decision. But again, I have great confidence in his judgment.
Well, we can't talk about the war without talking about the other domestic effects, and that is namely the inflation, which certainly can be tied directly and indirectly to the war. Are you deeply concerned with the economy? What are your people in Kansas telling you about your businessmen and your bankers?
And my business people, whether they're bankers or car salesmen or real estate people or builders, are concerned. And they accept the fact partially that, and they give the President credit for trying to halt inflation. They also recognize that he did inherit some problems, and I'm not trying to blame the Democrats, but I would say that it's a matter of record that the unemployment rates were very high in 61 through 65. And about that time came the escalation of the war, and unemployment went down. But it's back up again now to 4.4%. We've lost 500 or 600 jobs in Kansas because of cuts in defense spending, but still the Congress... We may lose more. We may lose a base. We hope not. But again, if we're going to be fair and objective, we have to accept cuts. We can't talk about cutting spending and then refuse to accept the burden. So there is concern. The gross national product has gone down, but the consumer price index and wholesale price index have inched up, maybe not as rapidly as in the past. Again, I hope that the policies of this administration start to work very soon, because we're in...
November's coming.
Well, November's coming. I'm not running, but it's coming. And this would be a very volatile political issue.
That's right. Supposing we're right in the situation we are today, as far as the war is concerned, as far as our economy is concerned, and this is, let's say, November 1.
Well, I would send a card of condolence to all my Republican colleagues in the House and say I hope to see you in January, and then maybe pray for something to happen between November 1 and Election Day. Because I'm realistic. I've been in politics for 22 years, and there's no doubt in my mind that the war and inflation are the gut issues in this campaign year.
I think so. In 1958, if you remember, the Democrats made great gains in every House district. Where they made a gain was a surplus labor area.
They made a great gain in the Senate, too.
That's right.
And we are up to over 3 million unemployed. We're not as high as we were in 64 or 65, but that's history. The voters are saying, what is it today? They're not going to go back and give Nixon credit for having it less than it was under President Kennedy, for example, in 63.
They talk about new politics, but it's still basic stomach and pocketbook.
So I think we're, of course, again, we're told the inflation policies are starting to take hold. There is confidence expressed as recently as Wednesday by Secretary of the Treasury Kennedy before Senate Finance Committee. He indicated there was a little gloom around, but he still had faith in the policies. Well, I hope we can translate the faith into reality, because without it, I'm certain many are going to get elected on faith alone.
That's right. One of the other related subjects to the war, of course, is the very heartrending subject of prisoners of war. You have been as active, probably more active than anyone else, in trying to focus America's attention on the plight of these Americans who are being held in North Vietnam. Would you want to tell us how you think you've been doing and really what
you've been
doing?
I think we're making progress, and I say this because I've had many comments from wives and parents and children. On May 1, which was Law Day, we filled up Constitution Hall, for example, here. We had at that time about 800 or 1,000 between those figures of wives, parents, and children of young men who were missing in action in Southeast Asia, some in Cambodia, some in Laos, some in North Vietnam, some in South Vietnam. We're now in the Senate. A different senator, Democrat or Republican, is making a speech every day on the prisoner of war situation. Some of those on my committee, Senator Muskie and Senator Mansfield, Senator Dominic Goldwater and Stennis, have differing views on the war, but they all agree that our prisoners are not being treated humanely. And this is a thrust, or at least our hope, that we can attract attention nationwide and worldwide to these facts, that the injured are not repatriated, they're not allowed to communicate, and that they are not treated in accord with the Geneva Conventions, which North Vietnam is a signatory to.
What could an average citizen watching this program do, for example?
Well, I would suggest, if you're concerned, if the average citizen would write me a letter. I'm easy to address, Senate Office Building, Washington, D.C. I'll be here until 1974 unless something happens. So they can address letters or postcards to me, and I will transmit these either to the Swedish ambassador or to the Viet Cong or to Ross Perot, who's played a great role, the Dallas industrialist, or Mrs. Stockdale in California, who's the national coordinator for the League of Families, because if we did nothing else on May 1, we for the first time brought together wives and parents and children, and I think they've gained some sustenance from the fact that they were together, they made plans for the future, and they now have some new hope in what will happen, and they have great faith that their husbands and sons and fathers and brothers are alive and will be released. I might add, they strongly endorse the president's Cambodian policy, because, as they say, we have a vested interest, but if this will hasten the end of the war, it means my husband or my son or my daddy will be home a month or 2 months earlier.
The basic thrust, of course, of your campaign for the POWs is to arouse American public opinion, because you people believe that Hanoi keeps very careful tabs on American public opinion. Is this right?
I'm convinced of this. In fact, the mothers and wives firmly believe that even the little display we had or demonstration of interest on May 1, or even a speech on the House or Senate floor, means better treatment for their loved ones. And this isn't asking much of me or any other senator or representative. If this, in fact, means better treatment, then we ought to be doing it not only daily but hourly.
Let's pull back. We've been talking about specific things. Let's take a general look now at this Congress, which is now going into its last 3 or 4 months. What do you think this record of Congress will show when it's completed sometime, I'm sure, after Labor Day? It won't be by Labor Day.
Well, I hope it may be by Labor Day, but I'm not an optimist. I've been here 10 years, and it
never works, does it?
I keep waiting for Labor Day,
That's
and
right.
I keep hearing from the fellows who were here 10 years ago it was Labor Day then, but I think we'll have a fair record. We're going to have some postal reform, electoral reform. We've had tax reform. We're getting into we're passing the appropriations bills on schedule.
Much better this year than last year.
We hope to have some crime bills. And here again, I think President Nixon has really had the courage of his convictions in domestic programs with postal reform, draft reform, welfare reform. And I think he has properly chastised Congress, and that includes Republicans as well as Democrats, for a little foot dragging. So Senator Mansfield is making certain that we keep our calendar clean. And I have great faith that Jerry Ford and Speaker McCormick, who is a great American, will do the same in the House side. And it means to me that we're going to have a very productive Congress, maybe not quantitative, but qualitative.
What would this postal reform bill enacted into law mean to the average person who is a letter receiver?
Well, it might not mean anything for a while, and if it didn't, then we'd all be in trouble for having voted for or against it. But the average postal receiver is convinced, and I think with some justification, that the Postal Service has deteriorated. It's near a state of collapse. And the American people are very hopeful, and they see this as, just like many see the welfare reform, as some hope for better service or for better treatment of those who are welfare recipients if it's that reform, or for better treatment of students if it's draft reform. We're very fair and objective people in America, and we live on hope sometimes, and sometimes they're fulfilled, and sometimes they're not.
How good are your hopes today, looking at the broad spectrum of America?
Oh, I have great faith in America. I say at home from time to time, despite all our faults, and we have faults, despite all our problems, and we have problems, I have very few letters, in fact, have had no letter in 10 years asking how I can leave the country permanently. So nobody in my state, despite their frustrations and their problems, have asked me to get them passage, one-way passage to some other country.
And we'll be back in 1 minute.
They told us the apartment was rented. And they rented it to someone else a few days later.
If you're black, you've got to be famous to live where you want. You call up. The agent has a house. Show your face. It vanishes.
With the for sale sign right outside, the agent told me the place was sold already. I'll tell you why me and my family can't live in that neighborhood. Because we're black.
The ad said the apartment was $148. We got there, and the rent was $165. $165. There ought to be a law.
There is a law. The Fair Housing Law of 1968. And anybody who stops you from living any place because of your color, religion, race, is breaking that law. Don't let him get away with it. Write for your rights to Fair Housing, Washington, D.C.
I want to thank Senator Bob Dole for being my guest, and this is Joseph McCaffrey thanking you for being with us.